Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Dinner conversation growing up in Robin Ream's house consisted of her father telling the family what was wrong with the world, expecting everyone to agree no matter the facts. Does that ring any bells for anyone listening today? But instead, Robin would look for inconsistencies in his arguments and point them out to him. Bet that went down well. It's possibly no wonder she became an English professor and an expert in rhetoric at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She knows too well how and why conspiracy theories and misinformation can take hold. She also knows the antidote to political acrimony. We need to learn to think for ourselves. Her new book explains how. It's called The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times. And Robin Reams joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Love this first line of the book. I was raised to be a Republican housewife. Can you give us an idea what arguments at the dinner table were like for you growing up?
Of course. Yeah, it's a true statement, that first line. I was raised to be a Republican housewife. And a lot of the arguments fell on the stress of those two terms, Republican and housewife. A lot of our arguments had to do with what were the proper pursuits of a young woman like myself, and what were the proper political opinions about any number of issues that were swirling around. And, you know, at the time, I don't think I really understood when I was a young kid. I didn't really understand the politics that were in the ether, but I did understand what was expected of me as a young woman, that, you know, the proper aim was to learn how to be a good wife and a good mother someday, to run a household. And I didn't necessarily see that as interanimating with the political viewpoints that I was supposed to adopt. But as I grew older, I began to understand the whole terrain and the whole landscape was interanimating, and that in fact there was a very consistent worldview that impinged on the kind of life I was supposed to lead as a woman and how that intersected with any number of political issues. So in many ways, perhaps it was a benefit to me that I was raised to be something I didn't think I'd be very good at.
Yeah.
Housewife. It was the discomfort of imagining myself in that role. Although I did try to kind of follow suit and conform to the extent that I thought it was right for me. But I think the fact that it just, those high expectations never felt like a fit to me, helped me to begin to develop a critical consciousness, a desire to find the flaws and inconsistencies in those arguments. And so perhaps that just continued as I grew in my intellectual life and discovered the field of rhetoric, the field I'm now an expert in. I began to see my way of questioning things was really, there's a whole field developed precisely devoted to precisely that activity, the activity of questioning how arguments work, how they gain their ground, how they attempt to gain assent, how they have a kind of force and a persuasive power. That's really what rhetoric is about. So this book was sort of attempting to trace that narrative from beginning to think rhetorically to learning how to be an expert in thinking rhetorically. And this book is meant to share that with a wider audience.
Was your father an early example of a lot of what we see today, which is people who only seek out the stuff they already agree with?
He was. It was harder for him to do that in the 1980s and the early 1990s, because as he always liked to tell me, you know, there's a liberal slant to the media. That was something he used to say all the time. Before it became a major talking point here in the U.S., it's almost like a rallying cry behind Rupert Murdoch's, your neighbor, Rupert Murdoch's news channel, Fox News, here in the United States. And so at the time, I guess I wouldn't have, the way I would describe it is not so much that he only sought out things that he agreed with, because there was far less available that he agreed with. We didn't have cable television. He could only watch the main networks and the nightly news. He felt like his viewpoint was not captured. It was not reflected in those media outlets. One of the motivations and reasons, in fact, for writing this book was I had this strange vantage point of hearing opinions sort of barked at the television set every night that were not in the they were not in the public sphere. They were not things that I heard reflected anywhere but in the living room of my home. And over the course of the last couple decades, those opinions, which I thought of as private opinions, I thought of as private opinions in part because they were, I could tell there was a certain amount of shame around them. There were opinions that my dad wasn't going to air in public because they weren't reflected in public. And yet slowly over the course of a couple of decades, those opinions have crept into the great outdoors of American public life. I see an incendiary and volatile mode in the discourse of politics today that really was the tenor of those one-sided conversations in my household. And so I wanted to write this book just to maybe help to put a check on that tenor, to introduce some techniques and some tools from the ancient rhetorical tradition that capacitate a different way of thinking and a different way of talking that's less motivated by anger and outrage.
Here's a great line from your book. You write, or you ask, when was the last time you ran across democracy in flesh and blood? What about socialism, communism, totalitarianism, the political ideals we hold dear or passionately loathe are never encountered in concrete reality because they are abstract. Why was that an important point for you to make?
That was an important point for me to make precisely because my book tries to take on what I see as a great danger in political life today. And one of the reasons that we are as polarized as we are, and that's the influence of ideology and ideological thinking. And what I want people to begin to see through the book is that ideology, our political ideologies, are necessarily abstract. They're by definition abstract. We have a tendency to respond to them and think about them and react to them and react to these political ideologies or react from these political ideologies as if they're the most real and material things in our lives, as if they're the most, they're the most clear and present danger. But in fact, they exist in the realm of ideas. And so what that means is that the language in which our political ideologies circulate matters a lot. It determines so much about how we think about the world, about what we think is happening in the world, how we react to it, how we perceive it or conceive of it as a danger, something that needs an immediate response. And so I wanted to introduce that idea, not only to cast a light on the ideology of politics, as opposed to what we often take as the very real and material presence of politics in our lived experience, just to introduce that difference as a starting place, that often when we're talking about politics, we're talking about things that are not only remote from us in our own lived experience, but also that are driven by a set of abstract commitments that really exist in the realm of ideas. And because they exist in the realm of ideas, it's language that constructs those larger points of view. And so how we think and talk about those issues matters an awful lot. So we need to pay attention. We need to pay closer attention to the language of the ideology and the language of our political commitments. And when we do that, well, that's precisely what makes rhetoric essential, because rhetoric was the first and the original discipline that was devoted to studying language as language. And that was how it arose in the ancient Greek tradition. It arose precisely because the ancient Greek thinkers recognized that there was a very clear and direct link between language and political action, between persuasion and political action. And they felt that there needed to be a discipline that was devoted entirely to examining how language is constructed to propel people's points of view and to motivate their actions. And it could have catastrophic political effects, but it also could have excellent political effects. But there needed to be an apparatus for studying the language. And that was how rhetoric evolved in the first place.
I'm speaking to Robin Reams. She's an English professor and expert in rhetoric at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And her new book is called The Ancient Arts of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times. And you say one reason we're so polarized is that we just don't study rhetoric anymore, Robin. But is there a chance that by learning the rules and lessons of rhetoric that everyone will just get better at arguing the side they were going to argue for anyway? That might even have the net effect of increasing polarization.
Only if things go really badly. Only if things go not according to plan. I mean, one of the points I like to make, not only in the book, but in conversations about the book, is, you know, a lot of times people come to rhetoric or they come to me and say, well, how would I defeat this argument? Or how would I respond to somebody who believes this absurd idea? And one point I want to make is that rhetoric was never really about that. Rhetoric has always, I mean, Aristotle defined it originally as the ability of seeing the available means of persuasion. And what happens in that case is, as a natural side effect, because we can see how persuasion happens, how it's carried out, a natural side effect of that is becoming a little bit more critical and a little bit more skeptical, a little bit more hard to convince. And so one of the really positive side effects of that is that we become a little bit, we hold our beliefs with slightly lighter hands. We don't cling to our certainty and to quite the same extent out of a sense of insecurity or fear of what it would mean to let go of it. A natural byproduct of seeing how persuasion works and understanding on a granular level how language really influences what we think leads away from that sort of dogmatic fixation. So while it certainly is the case that over the course of rhetoric's long history, there have been people who have learned how to manipulate the tools, the tricks of the trade of rhetoric to deleterious ends, being equipped with the arts of rhetoric and understanding how they work means it's much, much harder for someone to use them manipulatively in that way. Because if everybody knows how they work, it's much harder to trick people. That was really how both Plato and Aristotle understood rhetoric. Plato's analogy for it was that it was a pharmacon, which is, in the same way in the English language, we have a double meaning for the word drug. It can mean something that has a sort of negative effect on us. It can work as a kind of poison against us. But also we use the term drugs to talk about them having a cure. They have a curative or a palliative or a therapeutic effect. They saw rhetoric in the same way. It certainly is possible for it to work its poison in the political sphere, but used rightly, it has an inoculating effect.
How has the concept of truth changed since the time of ancient Greece?
Well, it changed radically in ancient Greece. and oddly, in the Western tradition at least, it hasn't changed much since ancient Greece. Plato really did a number on truth, and it stuck with us for the long term. But essentially what happened in the ancient Greek tradition with Plato, and it was a deliberate attempt to define truth in a new way once and for all, precisely to put an end to the kinds of falsehoods that could wreak havoc in political life by causing people to believe that a certain course of action or a certain political response would be beneficial when it just absolutely wasn't. So in order to cut that manipulation and the falsehood off at the pass, Plato developed this representational notion of truth. It's a very long story to explain how he did it. It's very complicated as well. Mm. So I won't bore you with the details of how he did it. That's the subject of my first book, which is written for an academic audience. But I'll tell you just instead that what he did, the outcome of it and the upshot of it, was that he developed the concept of truth that you and I and everyone we know kind of latently carry around with us, the sense that truth exists in language, and that language is true when it represents the world correctly, and it's false when it represents the world incorrectly. It's a correspondence theory of truth. The idea is that truth exists in a sort of correspondence relationship, a relationship of correspondence between language and the world. So when I say it like that, it probably seems like so manifestly self-evident that, yeah, that's what truth is. Why would we even need to define it? But the reason we have to define it is that concept of truth was just brand spanking new in the 4th century BCE. Hmm. And it was invented in order to overcome an earlier notion of truth that seemed like it had the potential to do some harm. And that earlier notion of truth was the notion of truth that is on display in the ancient oral tradition, the tradition that existed before Plato. It existed before the rise of literacy created a kind of Gutenberg revolution or internet tech boom, you know, some other analogy that is similar to our own time in the way that a new technology can really change our relationship to ideas and to truth. But that earlier notion of truth from the oral tradition understood truth to mean a kind of revealing or a disclosing, a revelation. And the literal meaning of the term in Greek for truth was something being unhidden or undisclosed or disclosed, excuse me. And so the earlier notion of truth is actually still with us. It's one of the aspects of the book that I try to explain. It helps us to understand why, for example, somebody who can tell obvious, straightforward, proven, bold-faced lies, like, for example, Donald Trump, he can say falsehood after falsehood. It can be proven false again and again and again. But yet somehow his language has the ring of truth to so many people. It comes off as real and authentic as a kind of disclosing, as though something's not being hidden. It's being shown to them as a kind of revelation. And the ancient Greek tradition had a really good explanation for why that was. There was one ancient Greek rhetorician in particular, who was a contemporary of Plato's. His name was Alcidamas, and he explained that a speech can never actually be really fully true when it's written, when it's scripted. When it's scripted, the words are detached from the speaker, so they can't really belong to the speaker. They're no longer a part of their own body and soul. They're no longer truly an extension of the speaker. They're this false and timeless object or this artifact that exists outside of them. And really what the speaker's doing when they use a written speech, which was like the new technology in ancient Greece, it was like as scary as AI is to us today, is they're hiding behind some prefabricated words. They're obscuring, they're closing something off. They're not showing it to view. So you can see how with that meaning of truth, the idea was that something being written could never really be true. It could never really be a disclosure. This is something that Donald Trump is actually tapping into, I think, instinctively, unknowingly, that because he refuses to follow a script, and as somebody who watches and listens to an awful lot of rhetoric, you can even kind of see how much he dislikes a script, how uncomfortable he gets with it. He almost gets agitated by having to follow a script. When he's speaking extemporaneously, that sense that's created that what he's doing is telling the truth, the rhetorical effect of that, there's actually a very old and established explanation in the history of rhetoric for why that would be. And the idea is that extemporaneous speaking is just simply truer than scripted speaking.
Truer, or it feels truer to the audience.
Yeah, exactly. And an ancient rhetorician would say, not only it feels truer, but it is truer on some level if we're thinking in a different oral as opposed to literate notion of truth.
Very interesting. So is that why a third of Americans still believe the election was stolen in 2020?
I think there is a number of complicated reasons for why why that particular falsehood. But no, you're not wrong. That's part of it. That certainly is part of it. There are a number of reasons that the rhetorical tradition would offer as explanation for that. Another explanation or another reason for that explanation or another reason that that's been an effective method, a persuasive method that comes from the rhetorical tradition has to do with the rhetorical status of facts. We think of facts as having this life independent of rhetoric, life independent of language. But in fact, facts, in order to be a fact, they have to be packaged in language. And once they're packaged in language, they're kind of plucked from the world and given a kind of representational status. Well, what makes a fact a fact? What makes a fact a fact is that it's falsifiable. It's something that can be disproven. It can be proven wrong. What that means, rhetorically speaking, is that all it takes for a fact to lose its status as a fact in a piece of persuasive rhetoric is for someone just to deny it, to say it's not true, to knock it down, to gainsay it. And so rhetorically speaking, and this is something that rhetoricians have observed for quite some time, is that the status of facts in rhetoric is actually the opposite of what you'd imagine it is. The status of facts in rhetoric is not something fixed, immovable, certain, unarguable. It's actually one of the most fragile things you can introduce in a piece of rhetoric if you want to be persuasive, because if your persuasion is reliant on facts, really what you're doing is just propping up something that is waiting to be knocked down. And all it takes to knock it down is a simple act of denial.
I guess that's why lawyers agree on the facts before they get into arguments in the courtroom, because it's not much of a case if they're just arguing about what happened.
Yeah, that's a nice observation. That connects nicely.
How can we start to disagree better?
Well, you could start by reading my book. My book really is devoted to precisely that. And the idea of the book and the motivation of the book isn't to get people to agree about everything, but it's to at least get us to notice in the first place that what we're often disagreeing about is occurring in language to begin with. And if we think of it as something that's occurring in language, then the way to think about the disagreement, the way to understand the disagreement, is really to start paying attention to the language. And so each chapter in the book offers a different tool from the toolkit of the history of rhetoric for how to do that. But in general, I would say there are a couple things that work as really good starting places for each one of those tools in the toolkit. And one is to just begin by noticing what I talk about in the book as our hermeneutic circles. I talk about this idea of the hermeneutic circle. The idea of the hermeneutic circle is that essentially any act of interpretation or understanding necessarily relies on certain pre-understandings. There's a lot of things that we need to know a lot about before we can even begin understanding each other in a conversation. And we these days are not very good at recognizing our own hermeneutic circles. We're not very good at recognizing what kind of information we are persuaded by before the fact. We're very quick and very ready to lob an accusation of bias against somebody with whom we don't agree. But we're not very quick to do the same thing to ourselves, to be looking specifically at the ways in which our predilections and pre-interpretations impinge on the ways that we take on and interpret new information. So that would be a really good starting place. But also in the book, I walk readers through an ancient technique called stasis questions, and it's essentially a method for asking better questions. So stasis questions for ancient rhetoricians were meant to identify where exactly we disagree with one another, where our points of view diverge from one another. And their idea was that essentially there are only four kinds of questions, or there are only four ways in which we could disagree. And if we can't figure out which one of those four ways we're disagreeing with each other, then probably we're just having a semantic dispute. Probably that we're not even actually having a disagreement. Their four questions were questions of conjecture, which for the purposes of the book, I call fact. The question is essentially, does a problem even exist in the first place, right? Is there a problem? The second question, after having determined that there is a problem that's existent, is a question of definition. Okay, so if there's a problem, well, then what type of problem is it? Are we disagreeing over how to categorize it? Is that the issue? Once we've settled that problem, then it moves on to a question of quality. Well, how intense is this problem, which we've agreed exists and we understand together how to define it? And if we can answer those three questions, the questions of fact or conjecture, definition, and quality, well, only then and only then is it time to move on to discussing questions of policy. Okay, what should we do about it then? So I think in my diagnosis of political culture today, so much of the polarization stems from the fact that we fast forward, we jump right past questions 1, 2, and 3, and we land on question 4, policy, what we ought to do. We all have all these recommendations and points of view and opinions about what the right policy, what the right reaction, what the right law is. But we haven't slowed down to take the time to ask those preliminary questions. So in addition to being more conscious and aware of what kinds of predilections and being critical of the predilections that we're bringing to any active interpretation, I'd say we could also begin to learn some new skills in targeted question asking that aren't just about taking up an opposing point of view on what ought to be done in a sense of policy.
This is good stuff. Congratulations on the book. Thank you for getting us thinking today. It's called The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times. And I've been speaking to Robin Reams from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.